Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we've got a special show, two live interviews from the New Yorker Festival. One of the great songwriters working today, Jason Isbell, will talk with John Seabrook about writing songs, about getting sober, and about how much better it is to write songs while sober. And he'll play for us, too.
Staring at the pictures of the runaways on the wall. It seems like these days you couldn't run away at all.
That's a little later this hour. But first, the king of late night, who's now able to sleep a little in the morning. The New Yorker's local authority on comedy is Susan Morrison, and she's called David Letterman, without question, the most original television voice of his generation. Letterman was on late-night TV for 33 years, and even now, more than a year after his retirement, it's kind of hard to get used to his absence. Here he is with Susan Morrison at the New Yorker Festival.
David Letterman.
Susan, how are you? Nice to see you. Thank you very much. Thank you, folks. Thank you. All right, that's enough. Thank you.
Anyway, well, here we go.
First of all, thank you very much for thinking of me. It's a great honor, a great privilege, and I can't tell you how nice it is to be out of the house.
Well, we're so glad that you're here. And you even put on the nice shiny shoes.
Thank you.
Just
yes.
Beautiful.
New shoes.
Well, I'm going to start with a question that I know every single person in this audience would like to know the answer of, which is, what did you do today? What do you do now?
Well, what I did today is different from what I do now. Today, I got up at the crack of dawn and very excited about this event. And we have two dogs, yellow labs. One's name is Dutch, one's name is Sully. And I took them for a long run. And that's, for dog owners, you understand that that's a euphemism. And we got that taken care of. And then I myself went for a long run.
Hmm.
And that isn't a euphemism, by the way. And then I got on a train and I came to the greatest city in the world, and here I am in this lovely theater talking to you folks. Thank you again.
Okay, good. I'm sure the audience would like to hear about this program that you're doing, that you've done with National Geographic about climate change.
Talk
about that a little
bit?
Yeah,
I'd love to talk about it. And I'll tell you the origin of my interest in this. I was contacted by these people and they said, would you like to do a segment? And I said, yeah, because I can remember, I think it was President Obama when he was running to be president, said something that's become a cliche, but it stuck with me. And what he said was, what are we going to tell our kids when they say to us, wait a minute, you knew the climate was changing and you did nothing about it? And so I thought, holy crap, yes, let's do something about it. And I became converted in a very aggressive way. I thought, by God, I got a kid, and I want to be able to tell him that I did something. So this fit right in that plan of mine. And we go to India. And there, the point of our story was, the 400 million people in India without electricity, 400 million people. Prime Minister Modi wants to electrify these people. And the goal he has set, and everything about India is hyperbolic because of the numbers, because of the size. He wants to electrify via solar grid 7,000 homes a day. A day. Hmm. Try and get the cable guy to come out to your house before Labor Day. While people like Modi, some people dislike Modi, everybody is very optimistic that this can be done, but they need help. And my feeling about it is, let's turn India loose. Let's do everything we can. If they want to be the leader in renewable energy, the country that is the leader in renewable energy is the country that will rule the world. And why not? Turn them loose. Let's go. I wish I was smarter on this topic, but it's hard even for a dumb guy to deny So, yeah, have I answered the question?
You have, okay. Very well.
See, this is what I'm talking about. I'll just talk all night.
That's good. I'm just sitting here with my clipboard.
It's time to go, yeah.
Have you kept up with the sea of late night shows? Do you watch them?
What do you mean by kept up?
Do you watch them?
No, I've not seen them.
Okay, because I'm not, you're
well,
probably...
Well, let me amend that. I was a guest years and years ago on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, so when I was there, I guess that counts as having watched it.
Probably. You probably watched it online.
Sorry, yeah, sort of like I'm watching this show here tonight.
Well, because one of the things that's different about the crop of late night shows out there now is they seem to me, I mean, I never stay up late enough to watch them, and I'm not very good with a DVR.
Yeah, that's my excuse now, too.
But they seem to exist to create this kind of batch of YouTube clips that everybody watches the next day. And, I mean, part of your career as a host was pre-internet, but it strikes me that you never were chasing that kind of viral
thing.
You never.
You know, you're right, Susan. And people, network people and staff people would say exactly what you said. And I said, great, I don't know how to do that. I just didn't know how to do that.
Right.
I mean, all I knew was I knew Johnny Carson, I knew Steve Allen, I knew the kind of show they did. I taught myself how to do those kinds of shows. But to do shows specifically aimed, I don't even know how you get a clip on the internet. Honest to God, you got to get a guy or a woman, and they'd put it on the internet. But so, and they would say, oh, when you got to start tweeting. And I said, what?
Yeah.
What am I going to tweet? Who's going to see it?
But
it was. I recognize, and I talked to Biz Stone, Mr. Twitter, mm-hmm. Years and years and years ago, and I said, describe for me what Twitter is. And he said, it's my gift to mankind. That's what I thought. But you know, he may be right. He in fact may be right, because we now have a record of interpersonal communications, not just from me to you, not just from me to these people, people all over the world. But what I don't care about is Justin Bieber getting a Slurpee at 7-Eleven.
Well, when you started out, when Late Night started out, New York was just kind of coming out of what you could call its Fear City period, you know, when the city was broke and it was dangerous and it was about to turn into the 80s, you know, which is full of insider traders and vulgar rich guys like Donald Trump. But one of the things that you managed to do that was so great is to create a sense of New York for the viewers as if it were a small town. And I wonder if is that just a product of your Indiana roots, or was that a conscious strategy to make everything cozy?
You know what? I've tried to articulate this in the past. And throughout the years of the show, very little of what was seen or is remembered was of my doing. I was always lucky to have people who had great vision. I never wanted to be the funniest person in the room, and never was. I'm not even the funniest person in this room. and the first head writer that we had was a woman by the name of Meryl Marco. And when you invoke the notion of New York as a small town, she would begin her day with the Yellow Pages, in the old days when there were Yellow Pages, and she would just go through and look for neighborhood establishments. And she'd find a place, just shades. And she'd write down just shades. And then she'd just go, I'll be darned, just bulbs. And so we would go out and we would turn that into comedy.
Well, let's look at a very quick clip that gets across this wonderful kind of little Mr. Rogers neighborhood feeling, which is about it's the strong guy, the fat guy, the.
I can guarantee you this was not my idea. What this is, I had completely forgotten about this. This is insanity. This is, from where does this idea come?
Do you know?
No, I have no idea. but yet it was. And we went out and we shot it. We got a bodybuilder. We
need to look at it.
Okay, let's take a look.
It's great. Then tell us about it.
I'll be in the men's
room. We have it.
I'd like you to meet three very special friends of mine. You, sir?
A strong guy.
And you?
I'm a fat guy.
And how about you?
Genius.
You guys ready?
Yeah.
Let's go.
The strong guy, the fat guy, the genius. God gave them each a special gift at birth. They break it, they eat it, they solve it. That's the reason they were put upon this earth.
You have something for the strong guy to bust?
Yeah, he can bust the clock.
Oh, the clock, go ahead. And Rupert, do you have anything for the fat guy to eat?
Yeah, we have some baked ziti today.
Oh, baked ziti. And now, how about a question for the genius?
Well, on the periodic chart, what's the symbol for sodium?
That would be Na.
Right.
He's a genius. Do you have anything for the strong guy to bust?
Yes.
What do you got?
We got stereo.
Cool.
Appliances, electric.
And Alex, something for the fat guy to eat?
How about cream cheese? That's suitable for
cream
a bagel
cheese,
store.
Exactly. Yes, sure.
How much paper is in a ream of regular paper?
That's 500 sheets.
A lobster.
He'll punch it.
Some corn.
He'll munch it.
The genius.
Man, that guy is smart.
The natural enemy of the penguin is the leopard seal.
Mr. Strong Guy, Mr. Genius, we thank you from the bottom of our heart.
Wow, that's remarkable.
I could watch that all day.
That's delightful. And I will say, without the music, you have nothing. And Paul Schaefer and the man singing it was Will Lee, who is our bass player. I believe that they were responsible for that song. And once you have the song, for heaven's sakes, pretty much the piece writes itself.
It's pretty great. Well, it's incredibly gracious of you to give a credit to all of the smart, wonderful people on your staff. But clearly, as the patriarch of this whole operation, you know, you were curating it. You were finding these people. You were hiring them. You were kind of the you know, wellspring of the vision. And talking about your influence, Tina Fey once said, "Everything about Letterman's show informed not only our comedy, but our actual human interactions." Do you know what she means by that?
Well, she's, I mean, that woman is a comedy genius. I can only presume she was drunk.
I think what she means is that in the years since you were on the air, I mean, you know, irony has become kind of a default setting in not just in television comedy, but in, you know, ads for life insurance and fraternity parties and your accountant and, you know, and just the way we deal with each other. It's an awesome thing, and I'm wondering if you're fully aware of the scope of it.
But you know, it's like working, if you're working in a, let's say, an automotive factory, and you're building cars, and maybe you build 800 a day, you don't go home and look at all the cars on the highway and say, "My God, I built all of these cars." You just, it's one car at a time.
But, well, I'd love to talk about Carson for a minute. You've said that the first time you sat down next to Carson on the Tonight Show, you felt like you were sitting down next to Abe Lincoln. You know, he was so familiar. And I mean, I can say I feel like I'm the one sitting next to Abe Lincoln today, as you can imagine. But sorry, had to say something about the beard. But you know, and I mean, when you were starting out, you moved to LA just to be. Because that's where Johnny was, and when he died, you did the most moving tribute to him, you know, describing him as a public utility. Was Carson there from the very beginning as a model for you, for your career and your business life and everything else?
he was the pot at the end of the rainbow. You would sit at home and watch The Tonight Show, and a comedian would come on, and they'd say, ladies and gentlemen, here's Bob Stevens, and you can see him this week at the Comedy Store. And I thought, the Comedy Store? What are they talking about? And I found out that the Comedy Store was a place people could get up and do nascent comedians and do comedy. And so there was clearly a connection between the Comedy Store and The Tonight Show. So that's what pried me out of the comfort of Indianapolis and moved to California. And it worked exactly the way I thought it would work. I went to the Comedy Store the first week I was there, started working at the Comedy Store. I moved in 1975, and in 1978, I was on the damn show. So I thought, geez, that's, if somebody had told me 3 years and you'd be on The Tonight Show sitting there next to Johnny Carson. And it was remarkable. It really was like you're on a bus and you look over and you say, holy crap, it's Abe Lincoln. I've seen you on the $5 bill. How you doing, Abe? And he was, there are many people responsible for what success I attained, no one less than Johnny Carson, because his stamp of approval was far and wide.
After he died, when you did this beautiful tribute to him, you revealed at the end of your monologue that all the jokes that you told that night were written by Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so beautifully done, because it was, you know, no one knew until the end. And so had he been sending you jokes for all those years?
Yes.
After his retirement?
Yes, even while he was still active.
Wow.
The first time I was on the show, and he did this with a lot of comics, during the commercial he would say, you know, the joke you have there about the casket with the skis on it, he said, why don't you try if you move this and just end with that? So he was constantly tutoring. And then when we got the CBS show, I think even the NBC show, he was sending us jokes all the time. The thing that is, when you watch Carson, it's so troubling to me because the man is effortless. Effortless. And my instinct when things went south on the show was to push and try harder. Not Carson. He was the one, he was the rudder. He was the keel. He was the control of the show. Didn't make any difference what else had happened. Mm-hmm. You had Johnny. Whereas if the audience is not going for me, I'm out there trying to beat him up to get him to like me. Johnny didn't care because he knew people just loved him. And you look at the first show he did on NBC, you look at the last show he did on NBC, and if you had to chart it on a graph, it would just pretty much be like that. He was so solid.
Now, what happened if, I assume that you didn't use all the jokes that he sent you. Were some of them not quite up to it, or was that all right?
Johnny Carson sends you a joke, you're using it.
It's, you know, I edit Steve Martin at the magazine, and it's years ago when Carson was still alive, he called me and he said, Johnny Carson would like to submit some humor pieces to the magazine. I thought I would have a heart attack, so excited. And Johnny called himself and talked to me about them, and it was, you know, the greatest day in the world. And then when he finally sent the pieces in, oh my God, it was so beautiful. He sent an envelope with a piece, and then in that envelope was also a little self-addressed stamped envelope. You know, what a 21-year-old
yes.
college graduate does, sending his first unsolicited piece to a magazine, you know, so that if it was a reject, I would just fold it up and send it back to him. It was the humility of it. It was so beautiful.
Well, I think that's him. that is Johnny Carson.
Well, just 3 years after you had your first guest experience on the Tonight Show, my old friend, the wonderful late Peter Kaplan, called you Carson's heir apparent. I mean, it seemed clear to everybody that this was going to be your next gig. But after the bizarre turn of events that led to Jay Leno hosting The Tonight Show and you moving to CBS, you were in first place in the ratings for a chunk of time.
And 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
And then slipped behind Leno. Did that torment you?
Yes. Yeah. I was embarrassed by it. We didn't know exactly what happened. We just knew that we had lost our way. For a long time, because one of my precepts of life is always find somebody to blame. I would blame the network because I thought the problem was not me. I thought the problem was the network. And then I gradually began to realize that it's not the network, the problem is me. And then I was able to make peace with that. But it was simply that a larger number of people liked watching Jay more than they liked watching me.
But didn't you realize, I mean, it always seemed completely clear to me that you might not have been winning in the ratings, but that really you won. I mean, you had the audience that I'm sure you would want. But I can imagine that acknowledging that goes against some regular guy part of your psyche.
When we got on the air, we thought, oh my gosh, we know everything that everybody wants to watch on television. And then we found out that we didn't. And then when Jay started winning, and it was just like one night he wasn't, the next night he was. And we thought, oh, well, it's anomalous. Well, it wasn't. It went on like that forever. And so that panicked us. And perhaps me, because I was at the head of the thing, we did. We lost our way for a while. I felt bad for the network. I felt bad for my staff. I felt like I was failing the staff. I felt like I was embarrassed for my family. I got over it, but I still wish that we could have been the number one late night show. You know, the thing with and I never really talked about this with anybody, but I kept thinking that somebody would ask me to host The Tonight Show. I think I sent the message that perhaps I wasn't interested because I had numerous meetings with Brandon Tartikoff over and over and over again. And I can remember one in particular. He said, so, anything else? And I said, no, everything's great. And it occurred to me years later that anything else might have been the opening of, I'd like to host The Tonight Show. But I think it worked out all for the better.
Let's back up again for a minute. You were talking before about the shows that you watched with your father.
Well, the first show that we watched routinely in the house was The Ed Sullivan Show from what is now the Ed Sullivan Theater. And I can remember my mother used to hate Ed Sullivan. She just hated him. And I kept saying, Mom, it's the Russian bears. It's the acrobats. How can you possibly hate Ed Sullivan? And she says, I don't like it that he begs the audience for applause. Well, let's really hear it for him. Come on, everybody. Let's really, come on now. Let's hear it for the bears. And this so offended my mother because she thought, live or die by your performance, let the audience decide.
Right. Well, this I'm sure this whole audience is familiar with your mother, and I wanted to ask you how she is.
My mother is 95 years old.
Fantastic.
And she still plays handball twice a week. We just had. I'll tell you a story about Mom, and God bless Mom. You know, it's Mom, and God bless her again. But Mom's 95, so we all go to Mom's house for her birthday. Now she has five grandkids. Her favorite is my son Harry. So we're all there, and one of her grandkids is a woman who has a cooking book in this, like Edible Ohio or something. I don't know. She loves food, and she's very good at it. So her birthday gift to my mother, this is in August, is a tub with a lid on it of homemade butter, home churned butter. And I said, holy crap, what are you, Amish? So now everybody is oohing and aahing over homemade butter. Hmm. Now another one of her grandkids, Bryn's brother, owns a bakery in Chicago. So he's baked something about the size of this table that's bread. So now I'm thinking, holy crap, let's here we go, bread and butter. So they hand the tub of homemade butter to Mom, and she opens it up, and it becomes clear that she believes it's hand cream.
Now, I bet it does the trick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, trying to get the dog off her. Now, I know it's not nice to poke fun at a 95-year-old woman, but then when we got that straightened out and the paper towels and everything, the homemade butter and the homemade bread, well,
I
call
bet.
The cops. It was fantastic.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
David Letterman talking with The New Yorker's Susan Morrison at the New Yorker Festival this past fall.